Welcome back to the program. As we turn our attention to one of the core philosophies of politics today, we're going to talk about the essence of conservatism. What is it? Why does it often seem so unconservative, so radical and non-traditional, from its reaction against the French Revolution to the intransigence of today's Republican Party? We're going to talk about the things they have in common and how conservatism has come to its current place. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Professor Corey Robin. He's a professor of political science at Brooklyn College, dwells at the City University of New York Graduate Center, and it is my pleasure to welcome Corey Robin here to talk about his new book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. Corey Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. In many ways, we look at conservatism today, and it has come to mean, in the mind of so many today, as kind of a reaction against the modern world. But as you talk about in The Reactionary Mind, something very different than that when you go back to its roots.
Yeah, it's really a reaction against one part of the modern world, which is the democratic movement for greater freedom and equality, social movements of emancipation from below, the abolitionist movement, the women's movement, the workers' movement. Those are the movements that conservatism is reacting against. And in doing so, it doesn't react really against modernity. It creates a different kind of modernity.
Talk about what that different kind of modernity looks like, and talk about it in the context of its origins with Edmund Burke and the French Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, Edmund Burke is reacting against the French Revolution, a revolt of the commoners against feudal France, and he takes particular umbrage against the assertion of freedom, of emancipation on the part of these commoners to be delivered from the power of the people above them. And in reacting against them, though, he oftentimes is influenced by them. Over the course of the French Revolution, he begins to see that the Jacobins, the revolutionaries, are really in the driver's seat of history. They have a faith in their ideology. They have the masses on their side. And he looks at the old regime, the aristocracy, and he says, we don't have this. We need to be a little bit more like them. So what he does is to try to pull the things that he can from the revolution, but on behalf of a reconfigured, reinvented old regime.
Isn't this really an attempt, and we see shades of it today, to merge both elitism on the one hand and populism on the other?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I describe the project of conservatism in one sense as the project of making privilege popular. How is it? Because the conservative is not just asserting the authority of privilege. The most far-reaching and far-sighted conservative says we can't just reiterate those claims because we're facing a very popular democratic movement. We need to find a way of tailoring our claims, adapting our claims to fit this new democratic sensibility. Now, they'll do this in all different sorts of ways. One of the ways I look at it in the book is the slaveholders. Mm-hmm. They how can they defend this master class when not everybody is a slaveholder? And what they do is they try to find ways of making every white man a slaveholder, because the assumption is if it becomes impossible for every white man to be a slaveholder, that person will then be an automatic candidate for the abolitionist cause, and that's what needs to be forestalled at any every moment.
And the way that plays out in contemporary culture in some ways is in this notion of aspiration, in this notion that everybody can be rich, everybody can be successful.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the keys of the modern conservative movement. I mean, you see this particularly, for instance, in something like Wall Street. Remember, Wall Street was reviled throughout American history by most Americans. They were very suspicious of it. They didn't think it was a productive institution. They thought it was, speculators and all this kind of thing. And this really came to a head in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And what the modern conservative movement did was to try to figure out a way of making, to quote the title of a book that came out a couple of years ago, every man a speculator. How can we make every man and woman feel like Wall Street is us? They made a big deal out of making the point that all of our pension funds are invested in Wall Street. Everybody can be a little speculator themselves. And I think, that's a good example of this aspirational quality that you can say, everybody can be a kind of Wall Street trader in some ways.
Talk a little bit about how that philosophy has morphed from the Burkean idea and how it's gone through the changes in American conservatism, and it's taken quite a few twists and turns along the way.
Yeah, I mean, the point of the book is really actually to emphasize the continuity, even though there are those twists and turns. I would say, you know, one of the key things is, like we've already been saying, that the first effort was, you know, making privilege popular. And in the reaction against the French Revolution, one of the ways that they tried to do this, Joseph de Maistre, who was a French political theorist, was really key in this, was to try to show how the monarch, the king, was really just like one of us. He wasn't somebody who was sort of appointed from God or had, you know, necessarily an illustrious lineage. His key characteristic is that he's, you know, been victimized, that he's taken a tumble because of the revolution. He's walked amongst us. He's gone to the school of hard knocks, and therefore he's like us. So that, I think that was one of the early efforts, was to make the monarch himself seem like a popular figure. Then when we get to the revolt of the slaveholders, as I was saying, the idea was not so much that we were like the monarch, but that we ourselves are little monarchs, mm-hmm. right? So every man a slaveholder, let's say. Or if you couldn't be a slaveholder, you could be a slave catcher. You could be an overseer, something like that. And then with the workers' movement in the beginning of the late 1880s, 1890s, the idea was that every man could be an employer. Or, if not an employer, a manager. So there was a real effort to make American managerialism a kind of popular institution. So you were, you know, if you were a kind of line supervisor, let's say, in a plant or a factory, you were very much like the owner, you know, even if that owner was Andrew Carnegie or something like that. And then I think the last piece of this is, with the reaction against the women's movement, that was really one of the very major battles that forged modern conservatism. And one of the things that came out of that was this idea that, you know, every man is an elite because he is the patriarch of a family who controls his wife and his children.
How did the anti-status ideas of people like Oakeshott fit into this?
Yeah, this is a very tricky thing. You know, originally, conservatism didn't have this hostility to the state. The hostility to the state was really something that liberalism and radicalism, anarchism, really represented in the late 1790s, early 19th century. With time, though, and again, you see this, I think the slaveholders are a kind of early glimmer of it, but it really comes to the fore with the rise of the labor movement. With the rise of the labor movement and the entrance of more men and women onto the political scene with the extension of the franchise, right? You know, you have more and more people, men, voting. There are increasing demands that are put on the state in order to take on the real inequalities and forms of domination in the marketplace. And out of that experience emerges this anti-statist philosophy on the right. Now, we should just be clear here, it was never a consistent philosophy, and it continues not to be, because the very same people who are oftentimes critical of the state's intervention in the economy are celebrators of the most powerful form of state power, namely warfare. So you have this odd critique of the state when it comes to its intervention in the economy, and celebration of the state when it comes into its form of warfare.
Mm-hmm. Where does that streak come from in terms of that violent streak that you talk about as it relates to warfare?
That's a very old streak. I mean, I trace it back to Burke and to his whole theory of human nature and human psychology. Basically, in a nutshell, I think the argument goes like this. Conservatives oftentimes believe that the reason why there is a democratic reform revolutionary movement that they are confronting is in part the fault of the old regime itself, of the old ruling classes. And what a lot of conservatives say is the reason why we got the French Revolution, the abolitionist movement, the labor movement, is because we ourselves, our ruling classes, have grown weak. We've gotten too comfortable, too privileged, too cozy in all of our wealth and power and resources. We are decadent. And if we are going to confront this revolutionary movement and really battle it and destroy it, we need to become more powerful. And oftentimes there's a very physical quality to the argument, and again, you see this going back to Burke, it's the notion that our physical bodies have gone into decline. Teddy Roosevelt is another good example of this kind of an argument. And what they see in warfare is a form of spiritual and physical rejuvenation. In other words, and this is very important, the constituency, the key person you're concerned about in warfare is not the enemy. It's really yourself. You're trying to use warfare as a means of rejuvenating yourself. So that infatuation with violence really goes, you know, way, way back. Just a quick tangent on that, another interesting feature of it is that people like Burke and Joseph de Maistre, who I mentioned earlier, oftentimes are quite envious of the revolutionary movement precisely because of its ability to wield the instruments and tools of violence. And the question is, how can we do the same thing ourselves?
And the neoconservative movement in many ways kind of morphed that into something about the state and about American exceptionalism.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really came onto this topic in part by my sort of interest in the neoconservatives going into the Iraq War. And if you read a lot of the neoconservative defenses of both, you know, the War on Terror and the Iraq War, they're very interesting because what they say is something like this, that in the 90s, after the end of the Cold War, things were too good. The problem with America was that we had peace and prosperity. Now, when I read this originally, I was really surprised by this because you would think conservatives would be the last people to criticize peace and prosperity. I usually associated that with kind of anarchic new leftists from the 60s, you know, who didn't like bourgeois civilization. But you saw many of those same kinds of arguments amongst people like Irving Kristol, his son William Kristol, mm-hmm. Francis Fukuyama, people like that. And when 9/11 happened, it was stunning. Someone like David Brooks as well. All of these guys, rather than being horrified by what had happened, in a way, really welcomed it, 9/11, because they felt like it was going to sort of set a purgative fire in America and really force us to get out of our consumerist frivolity, to get out of the easygoing, you remember the go-go 90s, mm-hmm. And to finally face up to the challenge of what it means to be a world power. And oddly enough, Afghanistan became a kind of disappointment to them because this is way back when. Remember, mm-hmm. the U.S. toppled the Taliban within a matter of weeks. It was too easy. And so they very quickly set their sights on Iraq, in part because they felt like that was the beginning of a challenge. And then ultimately, of course, Iran. I mean, there was the famous, you know, after the Iraq War, again, that was a very quick victory at first. I think it was Frank Gaffney or one of those neocons said, you know, anybody can go to Baghdad. Real men go to Tehran. And so there's a real sense always of trying to confront a really powerful enemy in order to rejuvenate yourself and prove that you are as powerful as you fear you are really not.
And coming back to your point before, you talked about the go-go 90s, there was this real sense, among these people at least, that this decadence had reached some kind of apogee in the 90s during the Clinton years.
Absolutely. You know, and it was a congruence of factors. A, it was the end of the Cold War, so this enemy that had really, you know, gripped America for so many decades, all of a sudden disappears, not really with a bang, but with a whimper, right? It collapses of its own sclerotic, you know, weaknesses. So you don't have the Soviet Union anymore. You have this very quick victory in the first Gulf War. And then you have, beginning around 1995, this unprecedented, well, not unprecedented, but this quite a big boom where, you know, everybody is you know, living on easy credit. It's the dot-com boom. The stock market is doing great. And for a lot of conservatives, rather than celebrating that, as you would think they would, right, capitalism is going like gangbusters, communism is dead, right, those were the two key dreams, two of the three dreams of the modern conservative movement. Instead, they feel a real sense of melancholy. This was not the heroic life that they had imagined. If anything, it seems rather pedestrian. And they, you know, and Bill Clinton was the epitome of that for him. You know, here you got a draft dodger as president, declaring, you know, one of the things that Clinton declares early on in his presidency is that when it comes to geopolitics, military might is not nearly as important as economic might. And again, rather than welcoming this celebration of capitalist utopia, they were rather critical of it, precisely because it was so anti-heroic.
Which brings us to the point that you start your book in this conversation with Bill Buckley about capitalism.
Yeah. It was a very interesting conversation. I spoke with him, I think it was in the late summer of 2000. And remember, you know, Clinton is still the president. It seemed like Gore could very well win. The economy is still doing well. This is long before 9/11. And we were talking about the state of the conservative movement, and the issue of capitalism came up in the course of the conversation. And he said this, to my mind, completely astonishing thing. You know, he said the problem with the free market is that it's so boring. You know, you say it once, you get the argument, and then, you know, that's it. And yet we have to repeat it over and over again. And then he said it's like sex, which, we'll set aside what it means about how he thinks about sex. But the point is that, you know, for him it was the very dullness and repetitiveness of the capitalist marketplace that really signaled to him. And also, I got a similar statement, similar kind of sensibility from Irving Kristol, that conservatism really had to be about something more than the marketplace.
Because, in fact, that sense of boring was really a kind of Oakeshott idea, that conservatism was really about the familiar rather than the unknown, and that it was about, you know, the comfortable as opposed to the untried.
Exactly. I mean, this is what's so fascinating. Oakeshott, you know, is probably one of the most important theoreticians of conservatism of the 20th century, and that's exactly what he says, is that what a conservatism is really about, it's not a belief in God, it's not a belief in authority, it's nothing like that. What it is this psychic disposition we have to enjoy that which is familiar. And we value that which is familiar not because it's good, not because it's better than anything else, it's because it is familiar. It's mine, you know. And but what you find in conservatism is that the moment that you get to such a situation where you're comfortable, and again, this goes very back, far back into Burke's whole theory, that very comfort becomes a source of great distress to the conservative because they associate comfort with weakness, with decadence, and with decline.
Because that comfort runs headlong into this other conservative idea that you talk about, which is the romance of the extraordinary.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think in the end, that romance of the extraordinary is probably really the critical notion, the central idea of conservatism, even more than attachment, as I try to show in the book. There's a belief in human excellence, that there are people that are better than other people, and that what you need is a society that cultivates that excellence. And that such a society requires inequality as a condition. And the reason why that excellence is valued is precisely because it's so rare. And the minute that any kind of attribute, any kind of feature becomes routine, it loses its charm, it loses its sublimity, it loses its romance. And so I think what conservatism, and you might want to trace this back to the sort of the death of religion, more generally the death of God that gets pronounced in the 19th century, but what conservatism really is about is trying to capture, recreate, or create, you know, whatever verb you want to use, that romance of the extraordinary. And they see it in the most odd kinds of places. So, for instance, Joseph de Maistre, in the late 1790s, it talks quite a bit about Joan of Arc, right? This peasant girl chosen by God to rally the French nation. And although this might seem a bit of a stretch, I think you could see something very, very similar going on in the celebration of Sarah Palin on the right in the last couple of years. I mean, of course, she's now out of the picture. But you see it again, you know, in the temporary celebration of Michelle Bachmann, the temporary celebration of Herman Cain, always looking for somebody, this, you know, diamond in the rough, as it were, who didn't kind of work their way up the traditional way, but kind of emerged like Quicksilver out of nowhere.
I mean, you can also trace it back. I mean, coming back to Burke, which was this kind of elitism on the one hand and self-loathing on the other, and in that inherent contradiction, you see the strains of the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's this notion that these elites have gotten, you know, too weak and so forth, and that they need some kind of extraordinary figure who comes from the outside, who will rejuvenate them. I mean, this is one of the interesting things I trace throughout the book, is this oftentimes this sort of celebration of the outsider. I mean, again, we think of conservatism as the kind of, you know, it's the philosophy and the politics of the traditional elites, and it is, in a way, very much so. But what's interesting is that it's often been led by these very romantic figures from the outside. And Burke, of course, is the first one himself. He was from Ireland. His mother was a Catholic. He was rumored himself to be a Catholic in a very, you know, Protestant Anglican country. He was bourgeois in an aristocratic circle. Alexander Hamilton, mm-hmm. one of the great conservatives of the coming out of the American Revolution. Well, he was born in Nevis in the West Indies from an illegitimate, out of wedlock. And there was always a rumor circulating around him. Most people don't think it's true, but it's telling that it attached to him that he was the son of a biracial union. So he always had that mark of an outsider. Disraeli, in the first, sort of the mid part of the 19th century in Britain, who was Jewish, leading the Tory party in Britain. And it's just sort of that. And then, of course, coming up to the neocons, you know, Francis Fukuyama, mm-hmm. Irving Kristol, Justice Scalia, Clarence Thomas, you know, the whole circle of outsiders to WASP America that really reinvented the conservative movement. So, I don't know if I say this in the book, but, you know, the tag is that conservatism has always relied upon the kindness of strangers and really has needed these people in order to reinvent itself.
And where does that then leave conservatism today in a modern culture moving at the speed that this one is moving at?
I think, and this is a conclusion that I offer at the end of the book, and it's a very tentative one, but I tend to think that the modern wave of conservatism, by which I mean the conservative movement that first emerged in the 50s and the 60s and, you know, reached its pinnacle with the election of Ronald Reagan and then the election of George W. Bush, my reading of the conservative movement is that it's on the wane. Not permanently. There will always be a conservatism in response to a kind of emancipatory movement. But this modern wave that we have seen, I believe, is on its way out, despite the victory of the Tea Party in 2010. And the reason I say that is that the reason that it's on the wane is not because it has failed, it's because it has succeeded. Mm-hmm. It came on the scene in order to beat back the welfare state, the civil rights movement, and the women's movement. And for the most part, on all three fronts, it has been successful. The one front that it has failed, mostly because I think it was caught off guard by it, is the gay rights movement. But with that exception, I think it has been successful. And because it has been successful, and I take this from the testimony of conservatives themselves, who say that the animating purpose of conservatism is to react and beat back these emancipatory movements. Well, once you have achieved that, there's not much left for you to do. And so that's why I think, you know, and I don't know how long we're talking about here, and a lot can happen, obviously, along the way. But what I see is a long-term decline of this current modern form of conservatism. I think once you see a kind of resurgent left, which we may or may not be seeing right now with Occupy Wall Street, it's very early, too early to tell, mm-hmm. I think you may see once there's a real resurgent left that starts really doing things, I think you will see conservatism reinvent itself again.
Corey Robin. The book is The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. Corey, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.